The callers are kind of lining up here to talk to you. You ready to do that?
Sure.
Let me give the telephone numbers again if you'd like to talk to Joe Newman. The line still isn't the best in the world, Joe, but we will stay with it for a little while.
Okay.
In Los Angeles, the number 520, and all of our numbers end in talk, T-A-L-K. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. In Orange County, 750. Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena, your number 244. If you're out in the San Gabriel Valley, 448. Down in the South Bay, that includes Manhattan Beach, Rolling Hills, Torrance, that area, 679. And if you're in the Long Beach, San Pedro, Paramount area, Compton, Lakewood there, 639. 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. I'm Bill Jenkins, and with me on our phone from Lucedale, Mississippi, is Joe Newman. And we have Harold on the line. Hello, Harold.
Hi, Bill and Joe. I just want to start out by saying, Joe, we sure appreciate your efforts as a patriotic American. And, Bill, your effort for bringing this kind of information to us. Joe, I'm told by an inventor, the successful inventor in another field, that it's very important to copyright your blueprints and descriptions, as well as to try to get a patent. Have you copyrighted your book?
Yes, I have.
Okay, good. Because he told me, he said, there are all kinds of characters that can try to break a patent, but he says it's darn near impossible to tinker with a copyright. Joe, is there a possibility that you could, under the watchful eye, say, of the Bureau of Standards or the Naval Research Lab or somebody like that, or some prestigious private research outfit, put together a machine under their eyes so that there wouldn't be anybody claiming that you had hidden a pound of uranium inside or something?
I think the major thing I need to do at this time is just simply put the book out like I have done and let the public speak out.
Uh-huh.
And that's what's happening, and the way people can help me is to write their senators and congressmen.
Yes.
Asking them to get involved. I know that I've been informed that one congressman is planning on introducing a bill for this patent to issue.
Uh-huh.
And if people write their senators and congressmen asking them to get behind him, the congressman that's going to do that is Congressman Dan Burton. They had contacted me. I guess some of their constituents had contacted them and said he was very concerned about the problems with patent law and wanted to use this case as an example. And I think as the public speaks out, it'll cause this invention to go forward. And that's what the book is for, is so that it'll be in the public's hands and no power on this earth can stop it. To me, that was my insurance to be sure while I was dead alive wouldn't make any difference, that this invention will have a life of its own.
Uh-huh. I didn't get the name of the congressman who might introduce the bill.
It's Congressman Dan Burton.
Dan Burton.
B-U-R-T-O-N.
Oh, very good.
And, if you write your senators and congressmen asking them to get behind him, then I think that it'll cause that stand above a problem. This has only been done once in the history of the Patent Office where Congress has stepped in, and that's because a federal judge has been found to be been bribed. So Congress issued the patent herself.
Uh-huh.
Congress has the power to do that.
Ah. Well, very good.
And Congress has the power to do just about anything, as long as it's constitutional.
Yes.
Well, very good. I'm going to call my congressman out here in California on Monday morning and talk to him.
Senator Wilson has already been apprised of the free energy technology that exists, so he's you can beep it up with him, too.
Yes, yes. Okay, Bill, you're doing a terrific job, and incidentally, well, you've got him back on the line. I won't go into the out of body thing. I'll wait for November 9th, right?
November 9th, yes.
Okay, very good.
All right,
thank you very much, Joe and Bill.
Thank you.
All right, nice to have you aboard. We have Edson on the line. Hello, Edson.
Hi, good evening, Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Newman. First, I'd like to mention something about Nikola Tesla. As you know, I'm quite involved with his story. Mr. Basura, that was mentioned earlier, recently told me that KCET is contemplating a documentary on Tesla's life. However, since Tesla doesn't have too many friends in the establishment, doesn't have GE or one of those companies.
He sure doesn't have GE.
That's for sure. Anyway, the money has to be raised to put this program on. So if anybody's interested, they should contact Mr. Basura or the Tesla Memorial Society in Lackawanna, New York.
I understand that some time ago that a movie was made about the life of Tesla, and it utilized the enormous talents of Orson Welles. It did not speak well of J.P. Morgan and Wall Street, who were the nemesis of Tesla, and nothing ever happened to the movie.
Yes, it was made in Yugoslavia, and it was shown in California a couple of years ago, but private showing, and it didn't get too great a play, I'm afraid. I'd like to ask Mr. Newman about the electron spin effects in his device. And as I believe, Mr. Bedini's machine uses permanent magnets. And does Mr. Newman's machine also use permanent magnets?
Yes, it uses permanent magnets, or you can make it without permanent magnets.
The basic question is, would it work better without the permanent magnets, which would eventually bleed off their power?
But the magnets would bleed off the power?
Yes, the Gauss strength would be bled off by the constant interaction of the magnetic fields.
No, when you have a magnet there, you simply have another source of power. So you can get more energy out simply because that you would have two sources of power. If you only have one source of power, you will get that energy relative to that source. If you have two sources of power, you can expect a greater amount. But you can make it with it or without it, just whatever the mechanical design requires.
Mm-hmm. I understand. What I'd like to ask is, in your book, I would imagine the Soviets probably already have a copy, knowing how they operate. And if there's some danger that they all start, you know how they always say they invented it first, and they'll probably be using it for other non-peaceful purposes. So does that bother you, or?
No, not really, because I feel that this invention would do more toward bringing world peace than all the kings and queens and politicians and dictators who've ever lived, because that people in general really don't want war. You go to any country and talk with a parent who cares about his children, well, they really don't want war. When people have poverty and see their children suffering and et cetera, it's easy to talk those people into fighting. But you give those people material well-being so their children are fed and you don't see hunger or starvation or misery in their eyes, and their family are happy and well-to-do. And if you then go tell those people, let's go fight, they'll tell you to get lost. That's what this invention can do for humanity. And all countries need it. And the possibility of the fact that you have a tremendous energy source that people worry about, well, Joe, you can make a laser device, or you're going to increase the possibility of war. I'm a very practical individual. We have enough destructive ability now with atomic hydrogen energy that we could destroy this world several times over, all life on it, in just a fraction of a second. So what difference does it make that you may do it one-tenth of a second quicker? The important issue is, what can we do to eliminate that possibility? And what will occur to eliminate that possibility is make all human beings across this earth responsible to one another, to care for one another. And the way to do that is just by factual demonstration of caring, and that's what this invention can do, because I'm certain that in years to come, the work hour week will probably be 1 hour per week. Be no pollution. Space travel will be as commonplace as getting on a plane and flying from one city to the next. It'll be phenomenal, beneficial changes take place on this earth.
I certainly agree with your comments. One final question. What was the address that we could contact you?
It's Route 1, Box 52, Lucel, L-U-C-E, D-A-L-E, Mississippi. The zip code 39452.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Answering a good questions, and thank you very much for that. It's Open Mind tonight, and with me from Lucedale, Mississippi, Joe Newman. And we're talking free energy, the Newman device, and his battle to bring it into the mainstream of life, not only here in the United States, but the world over. Mark C.
My question is, I've heard a number of shows about free energy, one form or another, and to tell you the truth, from a layman's point of view, by which I mean somebody with a little bit of college physics and chemistry, I still don't exactly understand, in my terms, why and how this device works. And I'd be very interested to hear just a brief explanation of how, you know, what happens in this machine such that you can put in a little bit and get out a lot. I mean, I understand it's beyond the second law of thermodynamics, but what is actually happening?
Well, what you do is that you're not creating anything, and if you understand mechanically the true essence of the basic energy making up a mass, and according to E equals MC squared, you won't be dumbfounded, but the way it works is that you take electrical energy and put it into this system, and what will mechanically occur is that electrical energy simply acts as input, simply acts as a pure catalyst. It triggers the atom alignment within these materials, causing them to release gyroscopic particles, which are the basic building energy of all matter. I'm very certain that this is true. And as a result of that, you're converting that mass of that system into pure electromagnetic energy on a 100% conversion process. Now, you're not creating anything. All you're doing is simply releasing energy that has been dormant prior to this time. And so, you, as a layperson, you may better understand that before 1820, it was rigidly taught in the scientific community that there was not even a connection between magnetism and electricity. Therefore, if, say, Michael Faraday, who invented the electrical generator, had invented it before 1820, the scientific community of that time would have said, well, it's impossible for your invention to work, because you simply cannot, there is no connection between magnetism and electricity, so there's no way you're going to get any kind of motion, a rotational motion, from an electromagnetic device. And they had a simple test that they used to try to prove this, that they would take a magnet and put it perpendicular to a conductor and put current through it. Then they would say, now, if there was any connection between magnetism and electricity, when this electric current went through this wire, it would create a magnetic field that would cause this permanent magnet to align parallel with it. Just like if you took two permanent magnets and put them at right angles with each other, fix them where they would pivot, and you let them loose, they would align parallel. Now, what one of the students did, when a gentleman was conducting professor named Osbred, the student set it up backwards, and he put the magnet parallel to the wire, and they kicked on the current, and instantly the magnet aligned at right angles, and it shocked the entire scientific world of that time. And Faraday became then obsessed, well, if electric current can produce a magnetic field, then the opposite should be true. A magnetic field should produce an electric current. It took him 7 years to prove that. A very simple device, but it's simple after the fact. This invention does exactly the same thing. There's certain things taught in technology today that are taught that are totally false. But that's not anything unique about the history of the advancement of science. If you look at medicine or physics or chemistry, astronomy or geology, it doesn't make any difference. You will find that those people who made the greatest contributions of their time have never been criticized by their colleagues, because it's the teaching system that's the culprit here. It has been for 5,000 years, because it teaches a child to relinquish its natural birthright of curiosity. And as a result of that, a child learns very quickly at the first grade, nameless game is to memorize. The more exactly I can mimic that teacher, the better grade I will get. And so they quit questioning. And the way that progress is made is by questioning. And that's why that I invented this invention to start with, was when I read Faraday's generator, I was questioning what I saw and what was being taught of their conclusions of Faraday's generator simply did not match the facts. And so I started searching it out, and over a period of 15 years, I then came up with a technical process whereby I mechanically explained things that science has never been explained before, such as gravity and electricity, magnetism, inertia, quantum mechanics, and all by one gyroscopic particle, as well as a new source of energy. But you're not creating anything. You're simply converting mass into energy, electromagnetic energy, on a 100% conversion process.
I see.
Does that help you, John?
Yes, it does. I'm interested to know if there's a specific mass inside the machine in which the matter is converted to energy, or if
do you want to hang on, because we're going to have to take a break for news and everything, and
sure.
let Joe answer that question. I'm Bill Jenkins on this Saturday night. It's Open Mind. Sippy is one of those rare inventors that has come forward with a device that has all of the makings of something that could certainly change the course of human events and the way we live. A device that literally produces more energy than is put into it. And as Joe was explaining to it before we left, as he was talking to John, that it wasn't that it created energy, it was just tapping an energy that is already there that's been laying dormant all of this time. Would that be about correct, Joe?
Yes. And I believe John had asked me what materials were being converted. And what I'm using is just a conductor material. And it could be any kind of conductor. I use copper, but it could be aluminum, silver, any other conductive material. And you will get varying degrees of efficiency relative to the materials that you're using. Same is true of a permanent magnet. That energy is literally the mechanical essence of Einstein's equation of E equals MC squared. The gyroscopic particles in those fields is the basic building energy of all matter. And the same thing is true of that conductor. When you put electrical current in, it's simply that catalyst that causes those atoms to align. The prior technology teaches that a conductor is non-magnetic. Now, that teaching is totally false. It is so magnetic that it deceives the observer. And this little small bit of knowledge shakes the scientific community up when they hear it. But anyone who buys that book and follows the instructions and proves it to themselves, there's an old saying, the proof the pudding's in the eating. And I totally agree with that. And like I had said earlier, there's many people already doing exactly that and have written me and called me, both telling me the results they're getting, and that also people wanting to get into production of this unit once they have received the book. And I'm sure they have ran their own tests, or they wouldn't have felt so strong about getting into production.
Does that help you, John?
Very much. The thing that it leads me to ask is, when the material in the machine is converted from mass to energy, or matter to energy, if you were able to be inside the machine looking at it at that moment, I mean, would that copper seem to disappear, glow, turn into another form? Does it disappear from the machine and never come back? Does it just get converted and reconverted back again?
Now, you'll be taking that energy off, but you're taking it off on the basis of a 100% conversion process, and that's so of such a tremendous magnitude that we don't have a scale or any detection means by which we can observe the change in the mass of that material. But it is a phenomenal amount of energy. You are already using up that material. But it would literally take you thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years to do so.
I see. Okay, well, thanks very much.
All right, John, good questions. Appreciate them.
Bill, can I just ask you one question?
Sure.
Ben, I'm there in, you know, discussing this in California. I just have a question that I'd like the listeners to hear. I don't want to voice any opinion about it, but as well as President Reagan. And I'd just like to read a letter that I had gotten back from President Reagan's office, and let the listeners try to draw their own opinion.
Okay.
This is dated March 24th, 1984. Dear Mr. Newman, on behalf of President Reagan, I want to thank you for your letter and enclosures. The President appreciates the time you've taken to bring your invention to his attention. However, I'm sorry that this must be a disappointing response to your request. so many similar requests are received that it just is not possible to comply. I hope you will understand. To the President's best wishes, sincerely, Ann Higgins, Special Assistant to the President and Director of Correspondence. And getting that material, you'd think, well, basically they just got it and sent it back without it doing anything with it. I sent them quite a bit of material, videotapes and et cetera. However, someone goofed up there. What they did, it stuck in a video review that I was not supposed to get. What it says on it, date received by the White House, 11/21/83, date reviewed, 3-3-84, initials of viewer, AMK, video sent to, RR, summary. A new energy source, electromagnetic device. John Dennis requested funding, needs help to get U.S. patents. Some scientists believe this invention could change the world as it converts mass into energy. Runs on its own energy. But the WLTV, Channel 4 in New Orleans, gives it excellent coverage. And then got a check at the bottom, both locations to Chuck Donovan, room 94. My question is, what do those listeners think about that?
So it got to the White House. You were sort of brushed off about it, but it did get reviewed and went on down the line. Is that basically?
And, I find it interesting now that you know, it would seem to me that the people who reviewed this tape, you know, given a summary.
Hello there. Did we lose our line? All right. We lost the line. They've been having power problems in Loosedale, Mississippi, and thunderstorms and all of that. Or maybe somebody pulled the plug. Who knows? But we'll do our best to get back with Jill Newman in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking to Jill Newman. We had our plug pulled there for just a second, but Joe, you're back, okay?
Okay.
So as we understand, you sent all of this information to the White House. You got a letter back saying thanks a lot, but no thanks.
Yeah.
But you also got a letter that was indicated that the material was reviewed and passed on into the corridors of the White House to Office 92 or somebody by the name of Donovan. Is that right?
Yeah, room 94.
Or 94.
Chuck Donovan, but, you know, it was the summary written of the tape. Now, this is a video review tape, and it was a goof-up. I wasn't supposed to receive this. This is an in-house memo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite obvious I wasn't supposed to get this.
What conclusions do you draw from that, Joe?
Well, I'm a person who deals in fact, and knowing that President Reagan nominated the gentleman, Donald Quigg, who is the acting commissioner, prior to coming to the patent office, he was with a major oil company for 30-something years. Now, he's the acting commissioner opposing this invention, nominated by the president. The federal judge, Jackson, Thomas P. Jackson, was nominated by the president in 1980. And all these people have acted outside of the law as far as the patent office and this judge. The federal judge, like, you know, he hired, as we discussed last time, we hired him, said he needed a master, and charged me $11,602.20 for the master, and the master said that the evidence is overwhelming, the invention worked, and that the patent office had not followed the formalities of the patent law, and I could receive a patent if I met the balance of the patent law requirements. And the judge said he wouldn't accept that, which was clearly a violation. The Federal Code of Regulations states that if a master is hired by a judge in the absence of a jury, he will accept that master's findings as clearly erroneous. When I see this type of response from the president's office, one letter indicating basically the material was all sent back as though it had not been opened. It's exactly the way I sent it. But in that, there was a goof up in the video review was sent in.
All right, so let me try to put this together in my mind. You had the incident happen where you sent the videotape and the material. It was sent back to you as if it weren't open with a brush-off letter. But inadvertently, there was a video review sheet where it had been looked at and sent on to Chuck Donovan in room 94. Meanwhile, Commissioner Quigg, who is responsible for the actions at the Patent Office was appointed by President Reagan, and Judge Johnson, who was in...
Jackson.
Jackson was the judge in your case, also was appointed by President Reagan. And Commissioner Quigg worked for the oil company before he went to the Patent Office. Is that what you're putting to us here?
Yeah, those are just the facts. And I'm just a person who relates the facts, and the evidence indicates to me that, well, the response I have seen... I would think, looking at the video review letter, for example, I would think surely if the information that some scientists believe this invention could change the world, is convert mm-hmm. biomass into energy, I would think that would bear looking into.
Well, have you contacted the White House since and say, hey, I received your letter. I also received your video review. I also am aware that Commissioner Quigg, who is responsible for the problems I'm having at the White House, was appointed by President Reagan, and he worked for the oil companies prior to doing that, and that Judge Jackson was also appointed by the President. I suspect something here. How do you answer that? What kind of response you get from the White House?
No, I haven't, Bill, because I'm certain that anything like that I wrote would be denied. And it could be even possible that President Reagan doesn't know about this. I'm not saying that he does. But it's also possible that he does. But being he's from California, I just thought that people of California would like to know these facts, and possibly they may be willing to write to him, asking him to respond to them.
Well, it's certainly a fair request that an inquiry be made of the White House, or perhaps the Justice Department, maybe.
And I do know that the response that I have gotten relative from the Patent Office and both the federal judge, Jackson, is totally a violation of the law. And the judge then sent me back to the Patent Office saying, well, I'm going to send you back to them and let them judge whether or not they have wronged you. Now, that's like someone who's stolen from you, and the judge sends you to that person and says, well, I'm going to let them judge whether or not they have stolen from you.
I'm going to understand that again, Joseph, very carefully. Judge Jackson said he's sending you back to the Patent Office to let the Patent Office determine whether they wronged you or not.
Yeah, basically that, you know, what he was doing was send me back to the Patent Office and start the whole procedure over again. You know, that's basically saying they're letting the Patent Office judge whether they wronged me or not. Now, he didn't use that terminology, but by sending me back to them as though it was day one again. That's exactly what he's doing. And even let them allow them to try to blackmail me by saying that if I didn't turn the invention over to them, my patent would be abandoned. Now, I would not submit to that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I would not give it to them. Because if I did that, I would be endorsing that injustice to be done to other people. And I'm saying, no, it's not all right.
Well, maybe the tack that Congressman Burton is taking is the right one.
Yes, I feel that it is. And it's through responsible legislative people like Congressman Burton and the other congressman there in California that I had given you the names, who had already written to Quigg asking him to act responsible. Now, he has not done that at all. In fact, he has stated in front of the Judiciary Committee several weeks ago that I had been treated totally fairly by the Patent Office. Now, my attorney, who's a litigator, John Flannery, in Washington, came out and told the news media that Quigg was a liar. And if he makes that statement, he is a liar. And I tell him to his face that he's a liar. Because the facts clearly show to anyone who's an objective person that the Patent Office has consistently acted outside the law, even to the point, Bill, that they had had a gentleman from NASA falsify an affidavit. They wrote it up for him, had him sign it where he was perjuring himself. Then the gentleman recanted himself. That's not me saying that. That's him saying it. He then recanted and said that the affidavit he signed initially was not true. But that's the kind of people I've been forced to deal with.
Well, is there grounds for action on your part against the Patent Office?
Well, I'm suing them now. And,
well, I mean, it sounds like criminal action, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's what I feel that it is. It is bordered on criminal action. And that these people have to be prosecuted or exploded in such a way that the laws will be changed. So this type of injustice bill cannot be placed against other people, because there's many creative people, Bill, as you know, that simply don't have a fighting personality. And if you treat them in such a way, you'll break their spirit. Or if they even hear about someone else, such as myself, say if I lost that fight and someone else is trying to make a pioneering invention, which this is, then that person who hears of that, you'll break their spirit. Why should they even try? Why should they even attempt if they think they're going to receive the same type of injustice? And the patent office only purpose is to stimulate creativity, not to stifle it. And that's what they've attempted to do. And there are some senators and congressmen that do care, that are starting to respond. But you and I both know that more senators and congressmen will start responding when their constituents start writing into them and saying, we want justice here. And not be willing just to take the normal kind of letter that they'll send back and say, well, this is in litigation, so I don't wish to respond. That's a cop-out.
Well, we do know that the most powerful force in America...